Good morning. Cracks, tendons, shims. Over the past 18 months, quality control issues with rail have become part of our lexicon. Construction engineering management expert Amarjeet Singh looks at the project this morning. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte says he wants a different relationship with the U.S. Patricio Abanales, the director of the UH Center for Philippine Studies, joins us to decode hyperbole from the reality he sees. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergrift. Kaka'ako Agora describes itself as an indoor park where creativity can thrive. It's the home of the upcoming Medicine Wahine series of arts events. We'll meet site manager Marissa Abadir. And Frances Rings grew up in the world of Aboriginal dance in her native Australia. She's in town to work on the UH Department of Theater and Dance's upcoming main stage concert.
That's the conversation for this Aloha Friday, October 7th. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to an Aloha Friday edition of The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. We've been watching in the news how the new president of the Philippines is making quite a name for himself.
And for a number of reasons. You know that, you know, some might call him colorful, others dangerous. Since the election of Rodrigo Duterte last May, the Philippine relationship with the U.S. and with the Philippine people have been changing. He has launched his own war on drugs and drug addicts and told President Obama to clean up his own backyard. This week, he also told President Obama to go to hell. Rodrigo Duterte says he wants to end the joint military operations with the U.S. But is all this hyperbole and bluster, or is it something more? Patricio Abanales is professor of Asian Studies in the School of Pacific and Asian Studies, also the director of the UH Center for Philippine Studies, and he joins us this morning to help us negotiate some of this. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
This has got to be confusing for people here in Hawaii who were able to vote in this election, in the Philippine community here, the idea that there was such overwhelming support for this man, and now here we are, you know, 6 months later, with a lot of questions. How do you begin to negotiate what you see and hear from Rodrigo Duterte and what it is you think he's trying to get across?
I think first thing, people voted for him because he had one theme, which is he's going to end crime, he's going to end drugs. But very few people know about him, apparently because he's from the South. He's the first mayor who became president. So national media didn't know anything about him until he ran for president. So they were expecting that. And then the other side of his personality came out. He's been very anti-American, not because of principle, but because of what happened in his city. There was an American who bragged himself as a bomb maker in 2004. The bomb exploded in his apartment. Then they arrested him, but then the U.S. Embassy came in and took him away. And that for him was a personal insult.
Because he didn't stand for the crime.
Yes, because they didn't inform him that, they were not going to keep him in the city. And there's the other side of him which people really don't know, that which is, yes, he kills. He has a death squad in Davao City which cleaned people out, cleaned the entire city. I was there when he was doing my field research when he started that. And if you watch him, it's really true. He drives a taxi in the evening to catch thugs and hoodlums. And then he has this fantastic practice of if they catch a thief, he calls on taxi drivers to line up at 8 o'clock in the morning and hit the guy one punch each. So Davao City is a fascinating place because only one of two cities in the Philippines where everybody stops on a red light at 2 a.m. And the entire city is no smoking zone. So there's a side of him that is people just realizing that he didn't run that city for 23 years just because he killed everybody. And so then that aspect, however, has been covered by the fact that he's launched his anti-drug campaign as a national campaign. Uh, So everybody's focused on that. Everybody also forgot two things. That he's, this is a very pragmatic president. He's anti-U.S., but the center, one of the major offices of the United States Agency for International Development, is in his city. It operates there, and it's doing well. So now that people in who voted from here realize that there's other things in him that's very contradiction, now they're confused.
But beyond confused, the idea of continuing to support someone who has this duality of personality. I mean, you call him very pragmatic, and you know that might be kind considering some of the things that we have heard about him and
Precisely.
That you have just talked about, the idea of just summarily killing drug addicts because they're involved in the drug trade. They have to get it from somebody. So if you kill off, you know, those who create the demand, then there'll, you know, be nothing left to supply.
Right.
Those things that we hear in the United States, especially as we're dealing with opioid addiction and we talk so much about the compassion towards someone who is an addict, seems to be such a disconnect.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. I mean, two things are happening here. On the one hand, if you view the drug problem in the Philippines from the national perspective, it's really not a major one. But he's talking to communities where, and like my hometown, where the mayor is a drug lord, where your neighborhood cannot move around unless you pay the drug pusher. So this is his populist theme. He addresses people at the community level, and people respond. That's why he has a very high popularity. Second is people also in the community realize that if you play by the rules of the game, that fellow is not going to go to jail. It's expensive to hire a lawyer. It takes you 25 years for a Philippine courts to settle things. And Mrs. Marcos is still free. I mean, she looted the Philippines for $15 billion, and he's still here. So that sort of frustration with the legal system makes people turn around and say, okay, solve this for us. The interesting thing is, with the exception of one mayor, he hasn't gone up. And narco politics is really part of any Philippine political process. You don't win elections at the governor, mayor, and even at presidential level if you don't get money from the syndicates. And the question then is he going to do it? Is he going to go up? It's more popular to kill people at the community level, but then at a certain point, it's going to stop. People are going to say, okay, how about this mayor? How about this governor? In fact, he's done it in my hometown. He's accused our mayor of being a drug lord, but nothing happened afterwards.
So how concerned are you then, knowing what you know of Rodrigo Duterte's personality, when we hear things that suggest that if he's going to make his own pivot toward, say, China, and obviously away from the United States in the way he's been talking for now, quite, you know, several months, specifically toward President Obama, that seems to be a real matter of concern for how the U.S. continues to maintain a relationship with the Philippines.
Well, you can do it two ways. What does the military think about it? The Philippine military has just started their military exercise with the U.S. Marines a few days ago. Is the military going to say, yes, we're going to go towards China and Russia? I don't think so. I mean, this batch of senior officers rose to ranks because of what happened in the West Philippine Sea.
But after what you've just said a moment ago, if he has that kind of control based on fear, doesn't that also apply to them? Are they not in fear of potentially their lives?
Well, you have to realize that this military tried to overthrow presidents in the past. So it has a tradition of saying no. The second thing that you have to understand are the economic side. If you look at his economic team, they're very much in favor of free trade with the United States, closer ties with the United States. This is also a team that's fearful of China's role in the drug syndicates. I mean, a lot of the ecstasy, heroin coming from southern China. On the other hand, this is a team that knows that China is the big market for Philippine goods. So you have to play that card. You have to steer a middle way for him.
So as you see that potential internal conflict, perhaps mitigating what we see in the United States and the real relationships that will develop as we go forward, both with China and with the United States, you see that as being much more of a leveling?
Yeah, precisely. Look for the boring people, the economists, the army people. Because I have a friend who works in his media team, And the unstated rule with Duterte is he has to only speak for 3 minutes. Unless you stop him at 3 minutes, he goes off tangent. And that's him.
That sounds like someone else that we
Andrew
hear.
Jackson and Donald Trump.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you
coming
very much
in.
For
I enjoyed it.
Me.
We'll talk again. Patricio Abanales is professor of Asian Studies at the UH School of Pacific and Asian Studies. He's the director of the Center for Philippine Studies. He was born in the southern Philippines and remains a Filipino citizen. His current research focuses on smuggling in Southeast Asia and what he calls the puzzle of why Filipino Muslims are pro-American.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It is 8:14, and coming up in the show, making the most of a creative arts space in Kaka'ako. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhawai.
You see it a lot, but maybe you've never taken a good long look. So, for today's backyard quiz, we're contemplating the state seal. In 1959, the Hawaiian coat of arms was updated to the present-day seal, commemorating Hawaii's statehood. Almost all of the depicted items from the coat of arms were changed. In fact, the only heraldic shield and state motto are left over from the original seal. In its current form, a rising sun replaced the royal crown and the Maltese cross, signifying the dawn of a new state. A depiction of King Kamehameha the Great and the Goddess of Liberty also replaced the two Hawaiian warriors found on the original coat of arms. There is one other notable change, and that's the addition of a particular animal. So, for today's quiz, can you tell us what animal is depicted on the Great Seal of the State of Hawaii? We'll have the answer for you in the second half of the show, but if you know, give us a call now at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to name it, get it right, gets the t-shirt.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Nohea Gallery, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
The Kaka'ako Agora was designed as a space where creative energy can converge, and its ongoing series of Medicine Wahine evenings puts the emphasis on female energy. It's sponsored by an arts organization called Kala Roots, whose founder, Marissa Abadir, is with us in our studio. Good morning, Marissa.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. What's the intent of the series of events that you're putting on?
The series of events that I personally am putting on is a exploration of the feminine continuum. Mm-hmm. It's honoring women as creators, healers, and innate nurturers.
Makes sense?
Yeah, it's pretty intuitive.
Sure.
It's utilizing the space down in Kaka'ako, as the Kaka'ako Agora suggests, as a gathering place. So the intent is to honor, as I said, which is done through a series of exhibitions, performances, circles, spoken word. We even have a pop-up AccuOasis.
Uh-huh. What's that?
Right. What is that?
Yes.
That is a collective acupuncture session.
Uh-huh.
My curiosity arose from personal treatment work that I have been receiving through a team of feminine or female Chinese medicine women, so
uh-huh.
to say. They have a clinic in Kailua. It's called Ola Nani. And I thought it would be fitting to close the series with an open acupuncture session and talking about deeper functionings of the body and the organs and their relations and qi and flow and whatnot.
Makes sense too, especially as a kind of a summation of what's going before.
Sure, I appreciate your openness and curiosity. Certainly,
openness and curiosity are kind of necessary to keeping this kind of flow of ideas going, don't you think?
I would say they are paramount to the creative process in general, from an artist standpoint to any sort of collaborators and then those that come to participate in the larger experience as they enter through these portals created collectively. Meant for self-reflection, identifying their relationships with themselves, within the communities, and essentially the world around us.
One of the things, Marissa, that I see, whether or not this is accurate or not, in the world of the arts is sort of walls coming down between disciplines, that you can't really just say that where poetry ends and performance begins or... You know what I'm saying?
I completely agree. I mean, this interdisciplinary nature is reflective to how we live our everyday lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so there really is no direct distinction anymore, as far as my opinion is concerned, and the group of creative folks that I continue to work with and whatnot. It's invigorating. It's empowering. It's representative of these overall feelings of cross-pollination, of transformation, of adaptation, innovation. When you surrender to the process and you trust that it's unfolding as it organically should and is in perfect timing, that's where the magic happens. And it cannot be identified as one thing or another, but rather it is all creation.
Did we, in the past, spend too much time putting things in separate boxes, you think?
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I feel as though in many of my formative years and studies and my undergraduate and graduate degree were the process of categorization and distinction and then understanding its relation and its interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
During my graduate studies, one of the biggest takeaways was learning through unlearning. And so what does that look and feel like? What is the approach? How is the community affected by it and whatnot? So...
Learning through unlearning, I'm trying to get my mind around that.
It's basically the sense that we've been conditioned by institutions, certain ways, categorizations, boxes, as you said,
mm-hmm.
Breaking that down, understanding them and what their function is, seeing where our place is within those fluid, nonlinear, cyclical formations, and then relearning either our innate knowledge, our natural ancestral wisdom and knowledge, and how we connect and then thus apply it to whatever our craft, our calling, our gift to the world, essentially.
When you speak of ancestral knowledge, is that sort of saying that there are things within us that we can bring forth?
I would say so, yes. I've been I know it to be true. We are all indigenous of somewhere. And so that exciting opportunity to explore our roots on a deeper level and where we come from, and once again, our connectivity to it and how it expresses itself in our modern, contemporary daily life is fascinating.
What's the pathway, though, to finding out what those ancestral messages are?
You know, that's an interesting question because today we are so many different things. Yeah. We've come from so many different places. I've worked specifically in the islands championing indigenous Maoli contemporary arts in a way that feels intuitive to my own understanding of my roots. Although I am not of Native Hawaiian ancestry, that type of honoring and support has allowed for me to go deeper as I'm farther away from I guess my homeland. I come from my maternal grandfather is full blood Egyptian, and my maternal grandmother Norwegian. And on my father's side, there's Native American roots and Irish, and it's a real melting pot. And so it's been quite a process to arrive where I am, which is still far from where I'd like to be, so
there's
to say.
Still a lot sure. Stored within, I would
think. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Marissa Abadir is the site manager at Kaka'ako Agora and a creative consultant for Kala Roots, which presents its next event in the ongoing Medicine Wahine series tonight at 6 p.m. It's an open mic poetry event, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
They're called sustaining members for a reason. They are the listeners who know that their monthly gifts mean a steady and predictable income for the station, one that allows this listener-supported operation to survive. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HPR can provide two program streams all day, every day. Your pledge of $10 a month or more will keep your public radio station strong, and we hope you'll consider becoming an HPR sustainer right now. Call us at 955-8821 or set up your monthly support at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. Hawaii now has a drug database, but few prescribers routinely use it. And that, according to Dr. and Senator Josh Green, is a big part of opioid overprescription. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
And you too. Now, given the fact that we know that we're seeing an opioid epidemic across the nation, certainly been talking about it here for quite a while now, the fact that there, you know, is such a thing as a database is a step in the direction. The unfortunate thing, according to, you know, what we've been hearing from docs, is that few of them really know about it or really use it, and that it's not mandatory that they check that before they simply dispense a prescription.
Right, and that's the exact focus of John Hill's story today. By the way, Senator Green, who, as we all know, is a state senator from the Big Island, he says there's people that will come up to him and say, I'm not going to vote for you unless you give me a prescription. And I think what that does is it illustrates how drugs can easily be abused in this country. And Josh Green, 2 years ago, set up a working group to see if there's ways to improve, strengthen our strategy to improve drug prescriptions, to identify those doctors who are overprescribing, and particularly identify those patients who actually shop around for doctors who will give them pills. They call them doctor shoppers. What a lot of states have done, at least 18 so far, is they've made it mandatory that the doctors check in on a regular basis to find out exactly not only who's prescribing, but who's getting the pills.
And what about the medical board itself? How much authority does it have to be able to mandate that?
Well, that's a good question. Our medical board actually has to defer to another board for regulation of doctors and licenses, and so it doesn't quite have the authority to be able to crack down on that. But if you made the doctors do this, then ideally you could lead to changing opioid abuse, drug abuse in general. By the way, Josh Green did pass a bill, and it became law, that allows doctors, other doctors, to check the database and their assistants and their nurses. As you know, doctors have a very busy schedule. And this helps them out. But it would be much better if the doctors themselves, at least once a week or so, check in on a regular basis to find out what's going on.
The other part of this is being able to identify those doctor feel-goods who just, you know, have no problem with being able to dispense drugs. That seems to be a secondary issue in having, you know, the policing of that by doctors themselves.
Fortunately, Hawaii is near the bottom for opioid abuse, both in prescriptions and overdose and deaths. That isn't to say that we don't have our problems, but we have looked at other states like New York. Since it instituted its law just a couple years ago, the number of doctors checking in just skyrocketed, like from a couple of thousand to in the millions. And meanwhile, the number of prescriptions dropped considerably. So even though there was some resistance at first from doctors, once they see the data, that becomes persuasive that this is the right thing to do.
So does this look like where we're going for the next legislative session, making this mandatory?
Wouldn't be surprised, but it's something that we're going to have to visit. And as you know, things move in their own funny way at the legislature, but Josh Green certainly thinks it's a priority.
All right, we'll talk more about that in the future, no doubt. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Bohr joins us daily from Civil Beat with a reality check. And now with a look at some local news that will be coming out of our newsroom come next week, News Director Bill Dorman joins us now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we've been talking a lot about what has been happening on the neighbor islands, but you have a story about a unique Kauai rescue.
Yeah, this one not involving hikers or anything like this. It's about birds, birds in trouble. The Newell Shearwater, the a'o in Hawaiian, a bird in trouble, in need of protection in any language, really. But they had an operation recently that brought some young, healthy birds from the north side of the island in the Limahuli Valley into a protected area where they can be raised and grow and develop. And it was a complicated deal. It involved all sorts of people, various groups, helicopter movement, all kinds of things. But it was an interesting story and a success story about that. And Scott Jarman, our contributing reporter from Kauai, is going to have more of the story behind the story on that.
Let's stay with the neighbor islands for a moment. We just talked a little while ago with Chad Blair about the doctor's database that can be checked for various prescriptions.
Sure.
And looking, though, at how many docs we have to actually make is still low.
As you know, medical care shortages throughout the islands is a problem, but especially on neighbor islands and in different areas, not just GPs, general physicians, but specialists. And one type of specialist that coming up this coming week, psychiatrists on neighbor islands. This is a real problem. The State Council of Mental Health is looking at what can be done. There's a statewide teleconference next week coming, Department of Health and others, and Wayne Yoshioka is going to chase that down a bit.
And, of course, we've got the pledge drive happening next week, which is big news around here, too.
We do, but we will also keep track of things going on in the world. I always reassure people that I see at the grocery store and elsewhere that, no, we're not dropping off the edge of the earth. We are doing pledge drive, and we do appreciate your support.
Good. Well, with that, we will wish you a good weekend, and we'll see you next week.
You bet.
Thanks very much. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. We'll be right back. And also on a Friday, you know, one of the things that we do is read your letters, your emails, and your posts.
And after listening to my interview with Paul Chappelle on the need for a paradigm shift in the way we think about violence and peace, Jason Gastrich of PAHOA said this: why don't countries not involved with war force every country that is fighting to stop and come to the table one by one?
Following Tuesday's show, Ian Yanell wrote, aloha, I'm happy sustaining member, and I just want to thank you for your show. I listen at least to pieces from the conversation most mornings, and I was so happy when I heard Neil Conan's voice back on the air a few months ago, maybe even a year now. And last week, I thought I heard Ken Rudin, too. And I confirmed today I did. I was so sad a few years ago when talk of the nation ended. I felt I was losing two great friends, but to hear them come back and on the local level is even better. So thank you for that, and please let them know I appreciate them and all the extended ohana at HPR. Mahalo to you, Beth Ann and Chris, and please keep up the superior journalism.
Thank you so much. Last night's town square, Janeth Walholm wrote, I wish there could be year-round summer camp programs in agriculture. We have so much prime ag land that needs intensive repair. I'd like to see grant programs where troubled kids can have a tent in a group living project to repair and prepare a few acres into things like high-yield organic farming and native forest restoration. Almost every week at our Hamakua Harvest Farmers Market, an expert shows up to our education program and talks about intensive restoration of prime ag land, who would love to mentor a small group of intensive farming trainees. Everybody feels better when they see their garden grow. I've seen many local kids find themselves in working the land and in producing traditional food and canoe plants. Thank you for your forum. And thanks for the letters. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Over the past 18 months, we've learned words like shims and tendons. Those terms, along with concrete cracks, are central to problems with rail construction that have called into question the overall quality of the project. And with reports that the failing items were put into place because they were initially cheaper, costs will likely continue to escalate as they are replaced. So where does the responsibility lie? Amarjit Singh is professor of construction engineering management, and he says that's a big issue. Dr. Singh, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
As we out here watch what's been happening with the build of this project and then see reports and hear much more of what's been happening on the inside and decisions that were made, how do you begin to assess some of the things that, you know, we now see in the external world that were once upon a time on paper? Who should we be looking to for some of these decisions in what we're now seeing?
Well, Beth, it really does require an investigation. And without actually conducting a management or performance audit, it's difficult to say what went wrong, where it went wrong, who did it, and what have you. But basically, when you boil all the issues down, it really comes down to effective procurement management, effective cost engineering, cost control, and value engineering, all of which probably are not being applied as much as they should in the construction projects of the nation and world, actually.
I hear you saying that we didn't know enough to be able maybe to ask those questions, or the people who were initially creating this project perhaps didn't ask those questions?
Well, it's a very complex issue, you know. I bet there are so many parties involved. There are dozens of consultants. There are dozens of trades. There are dozens of contractors, dozens of parties involved. Trying to get this huge mass of people into concert is never a straightforward task. It's really very challenging. And one has to do it in a cool-headed manner. But, of course, what you really need is people with a vision and a mission. Well, mission comes first and mission are both together, who can really look through all the complexities and focus in on what the end result should be. And it seems that there has always been some issue about the vision that we have.
In what way do you see that?
Well, in the sense that you need visionaries. You need, if you go back to the psychological tests, people with visionaries are more intuitive thinkers. And do we have enough of those? Some studies done for a state government agency many years ago reveal that really we don't have enough intuitive thinkers at all.
What would an intuitive thinker have seen perhaps in this project that might have saved us a lot of the grief we're now experiencing?
Well, I don't know who's experiencing the grief and how much, because I haven't been there. I haven't gone.
But, I mean, we are in our pocketbook. We're being asked to pay for something that we relied on a lot of other people to be able to tell us what happened in a certain way. And people are looking for somebody, I don't want to say, you know, to blame, but they're upset, they're concerned. And then we keep hearing reports about what's wrong with the project. And if you know this, if you say we didn't look, you know, didn't have the people who could look deeply enough into it with the kind of vision that you're talking about, I'm just curious what that might have stemmed at an earlier point if you're talking about how all of this was developed from a construction management perspective.
Well, leadership is the first thing. And trying to undertake a fair cost estimate in the beginning is one of the first tasks. You go into the project with your eyes open. You've got to have analyzed all the alternatives. You've got to be flexible in selecting various materials. You've got to identify the specifications well in advance. It's a huge task, and it requires a large group of engineers to really handle it.
For people listening to that who think, well, but didn't that happen? You know, weren't we doing that? Wasn't Hart responsible for doing that?
Well, actually, I don't know that much about what's really been going on. You can say in general, I can just talk in general. I haven't investigated the rail per se or the contractors or Hart. But in general, if you want to ask, yes, should the surgeons know how the operation has to be done? Yeah. Should the engineers on top know how the operation has to be executed? Yeah, yes, of course. They should have taken time to plan it all.
When it comes to some of the things that we're seeing now, like the, you know, the plastic shims, and we're told that, you know, those were put into place because they were cheaper. And for a lot of people say, but, you know, plastic, there are different types of plastic, sure, and different strengths, tensile strength, all of that. But for those who are, you know, continuing to wag their fingers at the project and saying, see, this is just proof that this wasn't executed properly, does that have any credence?
You'll see, wagging a finger is very easy to do, but very difficult to nail down and prove. One's got to sit back or set oneself back and look at the bigger picture of what really is going on. And do we substitute alternate materials on the construction site all the time? Yes, sure we do. Do we try to reduce costs? Yes, it's one of the major tasks of construction managers to reduce costs. Do we try to reduce quality? We don't really want to. We try to do the best for the least. That's a basic paradigm everywhere. And so if engineers have been trying to hunt for alternate materials to do the job better, quicker, more efficiently, that's quite fair play.
At this point, what would you like to see happen?
Where?
Pardon me?
Happen where?
In terms of the project itself. I mean, knowing what you see happen in the news and the things that we continue to see coming at us about the project, what do you think would be, from your perspective in construction management, what has to be the next step?
Well, basically, you know, a re-emphasis on going back to cost engineering and value engineering is something that might benefit the project. After all, We know that the state doesn't even recognize cost engineering as a regular discipline, even though there's a National Association of Cost Engineers. And we do have lots of value engineers in the country, but I don't believe Hart has used value engineers on this project when they could have really benefited from their expertise to a great extent.
Dr. Singh, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Amarjit Singh is Professor of Construction Engineering Management at UH Manoa. He's also a licensed professional engineer.
Aloha, I'm Francesco Crozara, jazz musician. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everybody. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. On his last day on Earth, someone asked Senator Inouye how he wanted to be remembered. He said he wanted to be thought of as someone who represented the people honestly and to the best of his abilities. He thought he'd done okay. After he passed, the Daniel K. Inouye Institute was founded at the Hawaii Community Foundation to preserve his papers, tell his life story, and share oral histories of Hawaii. It offers support for middle and high school students to develop their leadership skills. And there is the Dan and Maggie Inouye Endowed Chair, funding for a distinguished visiting scholar at UH Manoa, and a distinguished lecture series which so far has included former Secretaries of State Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell. The Inouye Institute partnered with the Smithsonian Institute for their What It Means to Be an American project. The Daniel K. Inouye Institute. This is a sort of thing that can be achieved through legacy funding. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Earlier in the program, we asked you to name the animal depicted on the Hawaii State Seal and tell us what it represents. In 1959, the Hawaii coat of arms was replaced by the current state seal commemorating Hawaii's statehood. And while the state motto was left unchanged, many features of the old coat of arms were replaced in the redesign process. One of these changes was the addition of a symbolic mythological creature. The animal in question is commonly found throughout the mythological world, generally representing rebirth or resurrection. On the lower part, our state seal, a phoenix, can be seen bursting from the flames, signifying the rebirth of Hawaii as a U.S. state. And, of course, phoenix, then, is today's answer. If you find yourself near the state capitol, keep an eye out for several replicas of the state seal that stand 15 feet tall and weigh 7,500 pounds.
Ryan Quinn called us from Kihei, knew that phoenix was the answer to today's quiz, and will be receiving the HPR T-shirt. Now, if you've got a quiz question for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll take a look at it, vet it, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Frances Rings grew up in the world of indigenous dance in her native Australia, a world where choreography is closely linked to the stories it tells. She's in Hawaii to work on an upcoming dance and new media installation concert that will assimilate dance languages from different cultures and very likely lead to something entirely new. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Frances.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My first association with Aboriginal dance is the idea of it as a form of storytelling. Is that an accurate perception?
Yeah, absolutely. The arts were our, and still is, our major form of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Our stories, our myths, our creation stories, our dreaming, it lies in our songs, in our dances,
mm-hmm.
In our paintings. So art form was our, I guess, our method of documentation. And it's still, I think, very important to us to be able to find a place for those stories in our contemporary lives today. Yeah.
Well, that's where your history is contained, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, we still believe and still acknowledge our dreaming living alongside us today. We have our contemporary lives, and we also have our ancestral lives as well that live alongside us.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to us as Indigenous people that that's a daily affirmation, that is something that we acknowledge, that we proudly identify with, and that we pass that on to our children.
When you say living alongside us in the sense of spirits?
In the sense of, so our dreaming is a connection to mm-hmm. the unseen. So in Australia, our country is crisscrossed by what we call song lines. And these song lines are, for us, they were the journeys of our creation beings that mm-hmm. brought us into where we are today. So for us, we still firmly believe in a connection to those. It's something that, you know, I guess, communicate through our songs and dances. Today it has a more kind of contemporary, I suppose, interpretation. But the resonance, I think, and is still something that we draw from a very ancient place, yeah.
Because your work has been described as contemporary Aboriginal dance, and that almost seems contradictory.
Oh, no, not at all. It's not contradictory. It's expression. It's about... I'll never have the experience that my mother had.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate to be born in a hospital. My mother was born in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
She was fortunate to grow up and speak her traditional language. I was not... given that same possibility. So, you know, the experience of my mother compared to myself are completely different. But the way that I honour her and my grandmother and my connection to my country is by doing what I do, my art form, about being able to communicate the historical experience of my people and also about my connection to country. That belonging will always be there. And you can have a city on that country. To us Indigenous people, it doesn't matter. That country still belongs to us. And that country still, you know, it contains our stories. It contains our middens. It contains our artifacts. It contains the ancestral bones of our people. And that'll be something that that I'll pass on to my children. And we will always have that connection.
At some point in its history, was your culture suppressed?
Yeah, absolutely. Colonization is suppression. It's oppression.
Sure.
It's, yeah.
Because when you said my country, that automatically becomes complicated.
That I say my country?
No. There are different perspectives over whose country it is. Obviously, you're talking about the land, the earth, the soil.
Yeah, I'm talking about First Peoples and their connection to country that I inherit through my mother. And through that bloodline. So, yeah, it is my country. And, you know, was that sovereignty ever ceded? No, it was, it still continues to be for Indigenous people and the First Peoples of that country.
But it was colonized.
Yes, it was.
It was never ceded,
yes.
But it was.
Yeah, it was colonized, yeah.
And was a great deal of the cultural tradition lost from that, or
did
it just go under?
Like any colonized country, island, area, yeah, there are things that are lost.
Yeah.
But, there are still things that we practice. There are still languages. There is a whole reawakening of stories, of dance. So, people say lost. I don't know about lost. I think it's dormant. I think culture sleeps, and I think it becomes awakened through another generation.
Obvious parallels to Hawaiian culture, which is why I raised that whole issue.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
The need of the colonizer to suppress indigenous art seems to be universal. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, well, that's power, and that's, I think there are some countries that were possibly more, affected than others. In Australia, it's a long way away from the rest of the world, and so it does feel like we are behind in a lot of ways. But, I think in a lot of ways that there is something that, being so remote, that has protected us as well. So,
I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah. It's a big country. There's remote areas, and a lot of people in communities, in those remote communities, still hunt, still.
It's important to keep those things alive, isn't it?
Still pass on cultural knowledge, language. So, yeah, it's still alive, yeah.
Well, Frances, thanks so much for coming in. Good
Thank
to talk
you.
To you.
Thanks for
morning.
Having me.
You bet. Frances Rings is the artist in residence at the NISDA Dance College in Australia. She's in Hawaii to work with the UH Department of Theater and Dance on its Dance and New Media Installation Concert coming up at Kennedy Theater. It's called Memory House Dreams, and it opens Friday, November 11th. Is not the only place that has seen a lot of its cultural traditions suppressed. I think that's sort of a worldwide phenomenon. It's pretty unfortunate.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for the moment, but the conversation will likely come back again.
Oh, yeah.
We know that one. We're going to wish you a happy and healthy and good weekend. Next week, though, when you come back with us, we're going to sit down with former Governor John Wahei to talk about the Charter Commission proposed amendments.
And as a gathering of the Maui Live Poets Society.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch, you can call the Talkback line, leave us your comments at 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or find me at BKOZHPR or on Instagram.
And if you want to hear today's show again, you can find it on the Conversation page on the HPR website. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you Monday with more of The Conversation.